Hello and welcome. You're listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. Hello and welcome to episode 33 of Writers Aloud. In this episode, novelist Jonathan Faller shares his experiences and observations and even some of his writing exercises as he directs a residential creative writing summer school in St Andrews. Following Jonathan, we're glad to feature some recent highlights from Vox, the short audio series from the RLF website. First up, here's Jonathan Faller with My Writing Week.
It's the first day of a new creative writing summer school in St Andrews here. I've been doing this quite a long time now. I think this is the sixth year that I've run this summer school as the director of the teaching side. And we get a couple of dozen students, all young, all in their teens, mostly Americans, although not quite all. And we have them for 3 or 4 weeks. And we do all sorts of things, different sorts of poetry, slam performance poetry, fiction writing, drama. We do radio drama performing into microphones. And we always start out at an introductory session with a little party trick that I do, which I learned, I suppose I can claim I learned it off Peter O'Toole in person, me and a couple of thousand other people. Because O'Toole was doing that in a stage show in London's West End night after night. And it involves just getting an egg through a biscuit tin lid into a container of water without actually touching the egg. You just have to whack the biscuit tin lid with your shoe. Easy enough if you've practiced, and high risk if you haven't. The good thing about this is that you can read the story in any number of different ways. It could be that the egg going into water is a terrorist bomb, so that if I manage to get the egg into the water, everybody in the room is saved from the explosion. If I fail to get it into the water, then we all die. Or it could just be a sort of rom-com. Could be that if I get it into the water, half the people in the room will win a prize of $1 million, and if I fail, the other half of the people in the room get $1 million and the first half don't. Then after I've done it, I get a couple of the students to do the same trick. And I've only met the students for about half an hour at this stage, so we're all just getting used to each other. They don't know each other at all. The breaking down of inhibitions is splendid. It gets them to really relax. They cheer each other on. They cover their ears against the possible explosion. They cheer and whoop when the egg goes in. They want to know if it's boiled or not boiled, and I don't tell them. And it's a good way just to start thinking about any situation from different points of view and how it might have different physical sensations depending on whether you're wildly excited about winning lots of money or absolutely wetting yourself because you're about to be blown to smithereens. A good start to the course. So I teach the fiction side of this summer school. On the second day, I've taken them down Scotland's secret bunker, which is not far from St Andrews. It's a rather creepy Cold War establishment where the government of Scotland was supposedly going to go into hiding when the Russians lobbed nuclear weapons at us. It's in many ways quite unpleasantly claustrophobic, but it's a fascinating environment, just the sort of place to set a story with people getting on each other's nerves. And then when one small thing changes in the environment, the lights dimming, a new smell, a new sound, that could tell you that everything has changed dramatically on the surface above, where maybe everyone is now dead or maybe everyone's now liberated. The students don't like the bunker very much. They usually re-emerge after an hour. But everyone finds it a pretty good prompt for writing. I'm very keen that they should be accurate about thinking their way into the heads of their characters, feeling what the characters feel in stressful situations, understanding the physical sensations attached to love or fear or panic or whatever it might be. There's a fine passage in Madame Bovary, which I give them to look at, about Emma Bovary in the kitchen of her father's farm before she gets married, and Charles Bovary comes in, sees her, sees the environment of the kitchen, and Flaubert appeals to all of our senses, or all of Charles's senses as he takes in the room. It's a situation of physical attraction between two people, but both of them have all of their senses absolutely a quiver as they try and work out the situation between them. I sometimes just get the students to lie on the floor. I say to them, well, imagine that you're a hostage. You've been captured somewhere and you've been taken into a basement, and now they're going to move you to another location. And so that you can't cry out or make any sound at all or work out where you are, your captors are going to wrap you up in parcel tape, broad brown parcel tape, starting at your toes, going all the way up to your head, strapping your legs together, your arms to your side, covering your mouth, your eyes, everything except for your nostrils. That's all that is left open. So all you can do is breathe and possibly detect light through the edge of the tape. How would you feel? I have them lying on the floor. I tell them they cannot move at all. And then I just get them to feel the different sensations that come over them. The beginnings of discomfort in the back of the knees, in the heels, all those places where people get bed sores as the circulation is cut off from the flesh. Those points on your body start to get very uncomfortable. What does it mean that you can smell fresh air? Does that mean that a door is open? Is someone coming in? Are they going to kill you or are they going to rescue you? What does it mean that you can hear seagulls? Does that mean that we're by the sea? Does that mean that commandos could come swarming ashore to rescue you? Or is it just a cruel taunt of an idea of freedom that you can't follow up? I spent much of yesterday evening marking a first batch of their assignments. Always it's astonishing how fresh and varied they come up. I sometimes get asked to teach a one-off workshop, maybe 90 minutes, for a book festival or a bunch of students elsewhere, and I have no idea how to distill 35 years of experience of professional writing into 90 minutes of how you are meant to write this or that. But at least I managed to convey some basic principles. What always delights me with my summer school students is that they come up with so many fresh ways of looking at things. I can give them the most hackneyed of prompts, and they'll come up with really quite extraordinary variants on it. The last piece of writing I asked them to do was about being trapped. It was about the sort of tensions and pressures and narrative possibilities that come out of a group of people stuck in a small room together and getting on each other's nerves and true character beginning to come out to the surface. They came up with endless possibilities, some the fairly predictable being caught in a lift, others quite different. One boy had written about being caught in a whiskey vault with three of his friends, with the doors slamming behind them and nothing but a mobile phone for light and 1,000 bottles of whiskey. One of them had written about being trapped in her own body, like being a hospital patient in something near to a coma who can't communicate or protest or say anything at all, but only able to see minutely the things that are coming for her, and finally protesting with a ghastly, wordless screech when the nurse closes in on her mouth with yet another spoonful of appalling chocolate pudding. Another student wrote about being trapped in an underground bunker with a young girl who spends her time painting the most weird murals on the walls of the corridors in the bunker. The young student's writing has some rather repetitive problems. They tend to overwrite the grand phrase, the big words, the issues of life and fate and death expressed in fine language that can be a little bit off-putting, but their imaginations are wonderful. Today, Thursday, was our play in a day. One of the components of our course has always been radio drama, which the American students, of course, are almost entirely unfamiliar with. We play them some samples of BBC radio drama, some very interesting ones. One is a ghost story set in a ditch in the East Anglian fens with ghostly tides and storms washing in over a sound recordist. We get them working in teams of five or six, and they have to come up with a plot for a play, a script, which they write together as a team. They have to edit it, rehearse it, and then in the evening perform it into microphones, all in the one day. Come the evening, all the students gather with a lot of their friends from other St. Andrew's summer schools, and we set up a row of microphones, and they perform live to the mixed audience. One of the skills they don't yet have is microphone handling. They're a bit inclined to either put their lips to the microphone and shout, so we get a blizzard of distortion, or in some cases they take a hefty grip on the microphone and sort of hug it and climb it, which doesn't improve the sound either. Still, it's a riotous evening. The results are, well, mixed. Some of them are very good indeed. Some of them are very funny. We often find totally surprising people suddenly shine as dramatic actors with microphones. A young man today really flourished. He had been quite retiring during classes, but suddenly he grasped hold of the microphone stand and gave an extraordinary rendition of a suicidally depressed salesman of vacuum cleaners who is suddenly taken out of himself by the great god of the vacuum cleaner and given a new purpose in life. It really was very funny. At the outset, the four groups of students have told my 13-year-old son, Kit, what sort of play they're going to be doing, and Kit has spent the day sitting at a table in the English faculty with his computer on the desk, composing instant incidental music on the computer to introduce each of the plays. A new day, and we've taken them off down to the Scottish Fisheries Museum at Anstruther on the South Fife coast, which is a complex of old buildings stuffed with preserved boats and equipment and the story of the fishing fleets. One of the things that young students find most difficult is getting out of their own lives, out of their own personalities, their own experience, and projecting themselves into other people's experience. I suppose you could say unkindly, being a little less self-obsessed. But they get the hang of it. They are instructed to go and look and think hard about what the lives of a fisherwoman would have been 100 years ago, try and project themselves into that life and write about it. That's the assignment I've set them for today. After the museum and a visit to the lifeboat station, where they get to hear about the tragedy of the Penlee lifeboat 20 years ago. Then we go walking along the coast from Anstruther to Crail, a few miles away. Glorious hot sunshine. All the students revelling in the brilliance of the sea and the gulls and the caves and the seaweed, and it's all just too lovely. Come the evening, and they're sending their assignment work in to me about the fishing and the fisher lives. Some of the work is really quite original, often permeated with the smell of the herrings. They've certainly got a feel for that. Sometimes they let curious anachronisms come in, which is a good lesson in not so much doing research, but at least just thinking your way into the situation of another time, another place. One of them has written, for example, about a poor fishing family in the 1850s and the wife having an affair with the postman who comes to the house delivering all those letters that poor fishing families in the 1850s would have received, quite apart from the fact that the woman should have been at work gutting herrings, but never mind that. Today is Friday, and I've set them a new task, rather different from usual. Always in the course we consider autobiographical writing or biographical writing and the sort of perils that it holds for authors. Not just the problems of finding good material or of offending people in your own family by what you reveal, all of which are real enough, of course, but also what it might mean to you to write something that is quite powerful, possibly things that you haven't really confronted in words before, feelings about events within your family that you may well have suppressed until they're given an escape valve onto paper. So I always leave this day until relatively late in the course, when the students are getting a bit more used to each other, and indeed to me, and a little bit of trust is beginning to develop, so that they feel less qualms about writing about close personal things. One of the problems with young writers doing this sort of thing is that they can be much too obscure. They want to speak about deeply personal matters, but at the same time, they don't really dare tell it as it was. And so they have a way of writing very, very obscure poetry, for example, which really doesn't communicate anything. That's one of the lessons of our classes, to try and find a balance between communication and dangerous revelation. Well, we've had some wonderful pieces come out of it today. One young girl wrote about herself through the eyes of one of her siblings, and this took us back to a time when both children were very sick and in hospital, and she told us afterwards that the sibling had died. Another wrote about a grandparent who had gone to Sweden and set up a factory. He was quite a ruthless businessman, but the one thing he didn't have in life was a wife. So a wife was found for him back in Germany and sent to him. She proved very satisfactory, he says. Another new day. Today we're out and about in the streets of Dundee. Half the group will be in the McManus Gallery doing a tutorial with the gallery education staff, looking at Victorian narrative paintings, of which Dundee's galleries have a collection of some rather cringeworthy specimens. The other half of the group is out with me in the streets. We just call this our back streets walk. We have a route which I've walked very thoroughly many times now, and it leads around all the old industrial quarters and the commercial quarters of Dundee, looking at tiny details. That's what I'm trying to get them to do, to read an urban landscape carefully. That means looking at doorways, looking at windows, getting them to look up, look at the top of buildings. The backs of buildings are often more interesting than the fronts of buildings. So we walk down Union Street, which has a lot of fast food outlets, and then up Clutie's Wynd behind it, which is a narrow little alleyway stuffed with extractor fans sucking out the hot, greasy, garlicky air from the fast food shops, and seeing a whole different world of what it means to work in such a place and to live surrounded by those smells and those flavours and textures and that heat and that stink. As we walk around, I stop the group from time to time and say, "Right, tell me a story." So I point at a student, and they have to just come up with a story about some detail immediately. We would point, for example, at all the little anti-pigeon spikes on the drain pipes and the window ledges, and student John has to immediately improvise a story about why those spikes are there. Well, he came up with a splendid tale about how Timothy the cat burglar was plundering all the buildings in Union Street, and the spikes were the only way they could keep him out. On we walk. We go into the old industrial quarter where the jute mills were. Some of the mills are still there, empty, ruinous, collapsing in a mess of barbed wire and asbestos and collapsed ceilings. And I get them to look up at the tiny little machine cabins up on the roof of the factory made of corrugated steel with collapsing conveyor belts coming out of the cabins. And imagine they were walking past here at dusk and suddenly saw as they looked up that there was a pale face looking down at them from one of those cabins. What sort of stories and lives and strange existences are we seeing there? A new day and a new speaker, a guest speaker. We have Rachel McCrum, a performance poet, who is teaching them about slam performance poetry, something again that none of them have done before. The day becomes really quite a riot. In our teaching room in the English faculty of the university, Rachel has them doing all sorts of things that are not usually done in the quiet, hallowed sanctums of the English faculty, to the point that after a while I'm afraid there are complaints from some of the poor faculty members who are trying to do their research in the quiet of the summer holidays. Some of the students are screaming out verses, and I mean screaming, verses of passionate intensity and quite a lot of obscenity. It's not really conducive to the quiet meditation on the sonnets of George Herbert. And so we come to the last morning of the course. We have them all doing a sort of gala reading in the old Parliament Hall of St. Andrew's University, a lovely room. There's a certain solemnity and also a certain sadness about all this. This bunch of 24 young people have never met before. They've lived and worked very hard together for 3 weeks. A lot of them have developed remarkably as writers, and now they're going to scatter again. They talk of compiling anthologies and keeping in touch. Some of them will. Some of them could go on to be really rather fine writers. I wish them all the very best.
That was Jonathan Faller. You can find out more about Jonathan on his website at jonathanfaller.wordpress.com. That's Faller, spelt F-A-L-L-A. Next, we're glad to feature two recordings from the Vox short audio section of our website, where we've recently introduced some new themes. First of all, here's Paul Sayer with Letter to My Younger Self.
Writing advice to my younger, slimmer, more optimistic self, circa the 1980s. So, you want to be a writer. Oh dear. Well, if you insist on pursuing this idea, your daftest yet, I reckon, the first thing I'll say is that it's not what it's cracked up to be. No, sir, not at all. Sure, in the era you're living in now, there might yet be some kudos attached to the so-called profession of being a writer, but it'll have been reduced to nothing by the time you reach my age. You see, there's a communication phenomenon coming your way that's quite beyond your imagination. An electronic superhighway, they'll call it, an all-pervasive presence in our lives to which everyone can and usually will contribute. Yes, lad, we're all like writers now. But let's forget the future for the moment. Rather, we'll consider your position at the point of setting out. You with your pens and pencils, your A4 pad, and the typewriter you use only for the very last draft of your scribbling, due to the ribbons costing more than £2 apiece now. And despite your 40 hours a week job as a psychiatric nurse, there you are, shovelling out the words. But to what end? What is it you're hoping for? Approval from your pals and peers? Well, there'll be none of that. Those who genuinely care about you won't know what to make of this. Being a writer just isn't on the radar for working class oiks like you. And even if you're successful, and remember that saying about being careful what you wish for, yes, if you are successful, it'll be even more bewildering for your nearest and dearest. In addition to which, the first thing any publisher or agent will want is for you to be someone else. And maybe you should take that advice. Get away from where you've lived for so long and change. Change who you are. Change for all you're worth. Not liking the sound of this? Determined to stay true to yourself? What exactly does that mean? Being some gloomy chronicler of the North, dispatching desolate tales about the grimness, oh, the grimness of life up there. But don't bother. The literary world quit the kitchen sink 20 years before where you're at now. But you'll find that out soon enough. Indeed, by the time you've had your first kidney transplant, now there's a surprise, eh? There may well be a few grudgingly respected books around with your name on the spine, but they won't bear any resemblance to the kind of stuff you'd hoped to be turning out. You see, not only are we all writers now, we're all middle class as well. Come on, son. Can I talk you out of this foolishness? No, I suppose not. Because the truth is that 30 years on from where you are now, with the wine aflow on some rain slashing Yorkshire night, and the bills as stubbornly unpaid as ever, I can occasionally look at a bookshelf half filled with my paltry efforts and think it has all been worthwhile. Well, almost. Your older, no wiser self, Paul Sayer.
That was Paul Sayer with Letter to My Younger Self. Next, here's Shelley Silas with How I Write.
Every time I begin a new project, I wonder how I did it the last time. Every time is like the first time. Writing for me is like maths. Problems to solve, surprises along the way. Sometimes solutions come when I least expect them. And ultimately, I'm the only one who knows the answers. Unfortunately, I was never any good at maths. I tend to meander for hours or days thinking about and thinking around my subject, researching, making notes, drinking tea, playing with a cat, ensuring the house is in order before I sit down to put that first word on a page. There's something about needing order, tidiness around me before I can write. If there's washing to do, or to fold up or to put away, I do it. Dishes to wash, I wash them. And once I start, it's as if a new energy takes me over. I also exercise several times a week, which I honestly believe is a really important part of my writing process. Sometimes I have breakthroughs while on the cross trainer. I don't believe in writer's block. Absolutely do not believe in writer's block. I believe in writing, whether it's rubbish or worthy of a prize. Writing is writing and you have to do it. Something comes from something. But being physical is a huge part of my working day. I work 24/7, not all that time, but I don't have days off as such. If I don't have a commission and I'm writing on spec, my routine is different and very much depends on other demands in my life. My elderly mother, meetings, exercise, teaching. As long as I achieve my goals each week, i.e. to read a translation of a play I'm adapting, to finish the second draft of a TV script, then I'm on track. I can mostly be flexible, but I never have time off. My mind is always working. And I admit that social media does distract me. And then there's email. I used to have to respond immediately to all emails that came through, but now I've trained myself not to do it unless it's really urgent. I adore technology, but it can be very distracting. I bought an app called Pomodoro, a timer, which can be set to write for a specified amount of time. It ticks away in the background and rings loudly when you've finished, congratulating you on coming to the end. Now I have two new apps, Antisocial and Freedom. They do what Pomodoro doesn't do. They completely block out the internet for as long as you tell them to, and actually it works much better. I mostly have the urge to stay home and write on evenings when I have to go out. Early evenings and night times are best for me. A Hollywood writer has said that there are sunrise writers and sunset writers. I'm definitely the latter. I generally need a couple of hours to warm up my mind before I get down to work. If I was giving my younger self advice, I would say, don't expect miracles quickly. Mostly it takes time. Very few are lucky straight away, and luck has a great deal to do with success, whatever that means to each of us. Write what you want to write, not what you think you should write. Don't imitate others. Your voice is unique. Take your time. Rushing to send something off just because you're excited about it will be detrimental to the piece of work. There's no age limit. It'll happen when it happens. Go out, live your life. Make the most of every day. Write because you have to, not because you have romantic ideas about a writer's life. And learn that rejection is a part of the job. Learn from rejection, embrace it. Do not look upon it as failure. And above all, keep going.
That was Shelley Silas with How I Write. You can find out more about Paul and Shelley on the RLF website, where you can also listen to many more short audio recordings in the Vox section of our showcase. And that concludes episode 33, which was produced by Kona McPhee. Coming up in episode 34, we feature the second part of George Miller's interview with the writer and broadcaster Michael Bywater. We hope you'll join us. You've been listening to Writers Aloud, a podcast brought to you by writers for the Royal Literary Fund in London. To subscribe to podcasts and to find out more about the work of the RLF, please visit our website at www.rlf.org.uk. Thanks for listening.